That is about 150,000 pounds of food in cash, which is amazing.
Nonprofits tally up contributions from the PFD's Pick, Click, Give program. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 7th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Division of Elections clarifies the rules and procedures for write-ins on the November ballot.
Stickers are not allowed by state law. Other than that, it's pretty open-ended. I mean, our statutes say you have to write in the name of the candidate and fill in the oval.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
The U.S. Department of Energy has approved the continuation of ConocoPhillips' Marathon liquefied natural gas export license shipments to overseas markets for the next 2 years. The approval allows the company to ship gas that was authorized but not yet delivered under a license granted in 2008, but not to increase the quantities allowed at the time of the original agreement. There were concerns about the export license in light of the uncertain gas supplies available for Anchorage and South Central utilities. But the department found that there are enough contract commitments and safeguards in place to assure that local needs will be met. Natalie Lohman of ConocoPhillips says those requirements have always been a part of their plan. She says the export of gas is necessary to stay in business to provide local supplies.
We really wanted to make sure that we could continue operating the plant. And then that makes more natural gas available to local utility markets in times of, you know, supply interruptions or, cold winter days. So while there's no, guarantees of anything, we have always been committed to providing and diverting gas to local utilities when they need it.
Anchorage Republican Mike Hawker has been active in the legislative search for gas for the region. He says without the federal order, the plant could have been shut down. Admitting that it sounds odd to ship gas when a shortage is looming, Hawker says that exporting makes it possible to fill the high demand periods.
The demand for gas here in South Central Alaska varies so greatly. It's much higher in the winter than it is in the summer, but gas wells only produce at a fixed rate. Gas wells don't come with rheostats that you can just crank them up in the winter and crank them down in the summer. So you must produce at a high enough level to meet your peak demands in the winter. And if we weren't exporting that gas in the summer, we'd have to literally be wasting it and flaring it. And that's completely against state law. So when you really look into all of the facts and circumstances behind this export permit, it's just absolutely been a critical part of the supply chain of gas to consumers in Alaska.
Democrat Chris Tuck of Anchorage also has been working on local energy needs for the Anchorage area. He says seeing the license extended can provide some comfort for residents until a new storage facility becomes available, now planned for the 2012-13 season. That will allow for a reservoir of 8 billion cubic feet of gas.
Because as we know, our utilities use 5 times more gas in the wintertime than they do in the summertime. And NSTAR uses 14 to as much as 20 times more gas in the wintertime. So this will help bridge that gap to where we get into that third-party natural gas storage, which will help stabilize the energy supply for South Central Alaska and help stabilize, hopefully, prices.
The storage facility resulted from legislation sponsored by Representative Hawker that came out of this year's session. The non-firm supply contracts and the gas storage facilities are now before the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. The storage application has been scheduled for hearings early next month. Public Broadcasting, the Food Bank of Alaska, and an Anchorage homeless shelter are among the big winners in the second year of the Pick, Click, Give program. Pick, Click, Give allows Alaskans to donate a portion of their permanent fund dividend to participating charities. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
More than 9,500 Alaskans donated about $925,000 through Pick, Click, Give this year. That's more than double the amount given during the first year of the program. Alaska Public Telecommunications, parent company of the Alaska Public Radio Network, KSKA Radio, and KAKM Television in Anchorage, received by far the largest amount in 2010, with 580 donations totaling more than $45,000. APTI President and General Manager Steve Lindbeck says it shows there's great support for public media in Alaska.
When people contribute this way, it's because the organization is sort of top of mind for them.
APTI was also one of the biggest backers of the program through public service announcements. Lindbeck says APTI received about $9,000 from the Rasmussen Foundation and North Rim Bank to air generic pick-click give PSAs on APRN. It also contributed about $21,000 in free airtime on APRN, KSKA, and KAKM. He says some of the spots that aired on KSKA included a tag encouraging people to consider sending their gift to APTI.
The first message we wanted to get out was, please give wherever you wish. Wherever your heart lies, give to that. And then the tagline was, if you love KSKA, please give to that too.
Last year's top recipient, the Food Bank of Alaska, came in second this year with 450 donations, totaling $29,450. Executive Director Susanna Morgan says that's a lot of food.
That is about 150,000 pounds of food in cash, which is amazing.
Put another way, Morgan says that's about four truckloads or just over 100,000 meals. She says the money will help fund food bank holiday programs, which feed Alaskans in more than 90 communities.
The Food Bank of Alaska is the hub, the wholesaler of the anti-hunger system. So we collect food by the truckload, and then we ship it out to anti-hunger agencies across the state, soup kitchens, food pantries, shelters, children's programs, senior centers, all of those kinds of things.
Anchorage Soup Kitchen Beans Cafe received $25,000 on more than 400 donations. That's up $16,000 from last year, according to Executive Director Jim Crockett. He says participation in Beans Cafe's food programs has gone up more than 20% over the last 3 years, so the donations are definitely appreciated.
Our major source of revenue is people like you and I that give $20, $25 a month. We've got an active 6,000 group, so we put it out on our newsletter. We put it out on our website. We put it out on Facebook. And any time that we give any talks out in the community, we make sure that we have the opportunity to let them know that we're part of that process.
Organizations will start receiving their pick-click-give checks over the next couple weeks. More donations could be announced as additional PFD applications are processed. In May, Governor Sean Parnell signed legislation making the program a permanent part of the PFD application. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
The State Division of Elections will be dealing with a lot more write-in votes than usual this November. KDLG's Adam Kane spoke with Division Director Gail Fanumiai about what will be allowed and how the ballots will be counted.
When questioned about whether or not a voter would be allowed to bring a piece of paper or a postcard into the polling station to make sure that they spell the candidate's name correctly, Fanumiai confirmed that it would be allowed.
Voters can bring whatever they need to assist them in completing the voting process.
According to Fanumiai, the rules regarding how a name is actually put onto a ballot vary. Stickers, apparently, are not allowed. However, stamps might be.
Stickers are not allowed by state law. Other than that, it's pretty open-ended. I mean, the name could be written in. I don't know the legal definition of what written in means. So our statutes say you have to write in the name of the candidate and fill in the oval.
Fanumiai says that the Division of Elections encourages voters to spell a candidate's name correctly. If the misspelling issue does arise, the Division of Elections will have to consult with the state's legal department to address that issue. With the large amount of write-in votes expected to be cast in November's general election, Fanumiai confirms that the results could take more than 2 weeks to be officially certified.
On election night, what happens is the write-in votes will be counted as just a group total of write-in votes. They aren't individually counted for a write-in candidate until the point in time it meets the statutory and regulatory threshold for having to do that. And we won't know if that threshold has been met until the last of all the ballots have been counted, which is 15 days following the election. And so the division then would not look at all of those ballots to determine who the write-in vote was cast for unless write-in votes received the highest number of votes for that race, or it was the second highest number of votes, and the difference between the total number of write-in votes and the highest candidate receiving votes, the difference was less than 0.5%.
Funumiai says that even with the large amount of write-in ballots expected, the Division of Elections won't need to hire more staff, although some temporary personnel could be retained for a longer period.
Following every election, we already have hire on additional about 20 hand count team members that do our statutorily required hand count verification following the election. And we would just retain those folks on to perform the hand count of the write-in votes if that is needed to be done.
Funumiai encourages everyone to check and make sure that they are registered to vote and to find out where their local polling station is located. Early and in-person absentee voting begins on Monday, October 18th, and the state's general election will be held on Tuesday, November 2nd. In Dillingham, I'm Adam Kane.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, looking back on the early years of the University of Alaska's Research Institute.
Government was eliminated because people used to call us Isagir, which has a rather hard sound, and Icer is much sweeter.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Hello, I'm Peter Kenyon, NPR foreign correspondent and former APRN reporter. Help support APRN's news mission by joining me on October 24th for the first of the new APRN speaker series. Go to APRN.org to reserve your ticket today.
An investigating officer at Joint Base Lewis McChord in Washington has recommended a court-martial for the Wasilla soldier accused of killing three civilians in Afghanistan. The recommendation now goes to the commander of the 2nd Brigade, 2nd Infantry Division for a final decision on a military trial. 22-year-old Specialist Jeremy Morlock is one of five Lewis McChord soldiers accused of killing civilians for sport in a recent Stryker Brigade deployment. All have denied the accusations. They could face the death penalty if convicted. Morlock was the first to have a pretrial hearing September 27th at the Army base near Tacoma. The state of Alaska has honored a Petersburg attorney for his volunteer legal work on behalf of domestic violence victims. John Hogue received an award from Alaska Attorney General Dan Sullivan during a ceremony in Anchorage last week, marking Domestic Violence Awareness Month. KFSK's Joe Vicknicki reports.
The award is the first annual Attorney General's Award for pro bono service, and it recognizes legal work that Hogue has done on a volunteer basis over the past 3 years. In making the presentation, the Attorney General Sullivan said legal representation for victims is a key factor in bringing down the epidemic levels of domestic violence and sexual assault in the state. Hogue says the honor was a surprise.
I had no idea that they even gave out such an award, so that was all of a surprise to me.
The 63-year-old has been practicing law in Oregon for over 3 decades. He still does some work there, but spends part of his year at a new home in Petersburg.
Most attorneys do a lot of volunteer work, some of which they, you know, get no publicity for. I've spent, you know, a good number of years giving advice to people as needed. And when we were moving up to Alaska, I received an email from the whole state bar asking for volunteers in this area, and I responded and said, you're going to have to train me, but if you know this, the program was willing to do that, I'd be willing to volunteer.
Hogue's career has focused on negotiating law enforcement labor agreements, and he received training for the volunteer domestic violence work from the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. That organization's pro bono project has had over 2,000 people apply for direct legal assistance and around 300 attorneys offering legal help since it started up back in 1999. The project's supervising attorney, Christine McLeod-Pate, says the legal volunteer work is critical.
Many of the clients who come to us are in desperate situations. They are all victims of domestic violence and or sexual assault, and many of them are facing serious issues in court, whether it is the potential loss of their children, they're fighting for custody of their children and access to their children, or financial issues such as child support and spousal support, which will be important to them being able to break out of the cycle of violence that they're in.
Hogue has taken on more than 7 cases for the network, including one client whose husband appealed the court's ruling on the couple's divorce to the state Supreme Court. McLeod-Pate praises Hogue's work.
He's, you know, came in and just has taken case after case and is a really tenacious and committed attorney to his clients. We're really lucky to have him. It's wonderful that the governor is highlighting people who have been working in the trenches, such as John, for many years on this issue, and we appreciate the governor's support and the AG's support in recognizing wonderful volunteers like John.
Besides the legal representation in court, Hoag has also put on a workshop in Petersburg on filling out a petition for protective orders. He volunteers with the local victims advocacy group Women's Aid in Violent Emergencies. WAVE board member Kathy Bracken says Hoag is dedicated and his expertise is important for the organization.
We're all volunteers. He's a volunteer, but we are. But this is his being an attorney. That's his profession. And we're retired teachers, retired public health nurses, and just people who have other jobs. And this we fill our time with this. It's obvious that he knows the law and he can cite all of the correct numbers and he knows the paperwork and everything. And so having a professional it's a whole world of difference.
Victims who need pro bono representation can get connected with an attorney like Hoag through groups like WAVE, and it's work that Hoag says he'll continue doing.
It's something that I certainly urge other attorneys to think about doing. The Network on Domestic Violence provided excellent training and resources for me, or otherwise I wouldn't have done this because it's a whole new area of law for me.
A recent survey released by the University of Alaska Anchorage Justice Center estimated about one in every two adult women in Alaska has experienced threats or physical violence by their partner. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
Alaska-based researchers are part of a group of marine scientists from around the globe gathered in London this week. They're sharing results from a decade-long survey of sea life compiled by 2,700 scientists. It's one of the largest scientific collaborations ever conducted. The University of Alaska Fairbanks has been involved in several components of the worldwide project. Oceanography professor Russ Hofcroft is one of three UAF researchers who led an Arctic Ocean Diversity Project. Hofcroft says it started with sorting through over a century's worth of marine life discoveries.
The big problem is a lot of the information has been fragmented and unavailable for us to do anything that would be considered easy to synthesize. So we had a pretty good idea in an overall sense of kind of what was there, but no central places where we could go and find it all organized. And one of the big things that has happened with the Census of Marine Life and our Arctic project is the effort to try and create complete lists of names of the animals that occur in the different habitats and in the oceans in general.
The Arctic Marine Database consists of 250,000 species. It includes previously identified life as well as new discoveries from recent years' fieldwork in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas and the Canadian Basin. Hofcroft says the UAF team identified 71 previously unknown life forms.
I think all of us found something new or surprising. Rolf Gradinger and Bodil Bloom found a small, effectively sea anemone that lived in the sea ice. This was an unknown habitat for it to exist. And they actually ended up naming it after their daughter. I and colleagues who work on zooplankton found actually probably a dozen or more new species, one of which has been described formally, several of which are in the process of being described.
Hofcroft says technology, like remotely operated submarines, have enabled new discoveries. He says climate change makes this a pivotal time for creating a database for Arctic marine life against which future surveys can be compared. He says while the first 10-year phase of the marine life survey has come to a close, the survey could continue depending on available funding. Another UAF-led component of the project looked at marine life in nearshore environments.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a pre-existing medical condition, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the new temporary federal insurance program being administered by ACHIA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. The program is for those with qualifying pre-existing conditions and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months. Talk to an independent insurance broker or go online to ACHIA.com. This message sponsored by ACHIA Fed. We'll be right back.
An official from the National Marine Fisheries Service announced yesterday that they would not be adopting the North Pacific Fishery Management Council's alternative plan for stellar sea lion management. The council had hoped that NIMS would consider relaxing the proposed restrictions and reducing the potential closures. But with few exceptions, NIMS is moving ahead with the plan announced in August. Effective January 1st, NIMS will be closing Pacific cod and Atka mackerel fisheries in the Western Aleutian Islands in an effort to increase the food supply for the endangered western stock of sea lions. Doug DeMaster, a research director for NIMS, says that while this is a difficult process with many stakeholders involved, adhering to the Endangered Species Act is the top priority.
It affects fishermen, it affects communities. It's something the agency is not taking lightly. But again, the agency has a mandate under the Endangered Species Act, and it's trying to fulfill that mandate.
Many representatives from the fishing industry are less than pleased. They estimate that the loss to the commercial fisheries in the Western Aleutians is about $30 million, and that the brunt of that will fall on only a dozen boats. David Benton is executive director of the Marine Conservation Alliance, an industry group that has been critical of both the science behind the decision and the speed at which NIMS is operating. He's concerned there wasn't enough time for the agency to review the council's management plan.
I think we're all disappointed that the agency didn't see their way clear to move in the direction that the council indicated.
But conservation groups are pleased that NIMS didn't weaken its plan. Michael Levine is Pacific Senior Counsel for the conservation group Oceana, and he says that the western stock of stellar sea lions are currently in a critical situation and that their continued decline demands immediate attention.
We're encouraged to learn that the National Marine Fisheries Service is standing by its commitment to abide the Endangered Species Act.
The council will be meeting through the end of the week and will be discussing the prospect of a scientific review of the biological opinion. Alaska flags around the state are at half staff today in honor of statehood pioneer and economist George Rogers, who died earlier this week at the age of 93. He's being remembered this week for his contributions to the young state, especially his economic understanding of Alaska. In this second of two features of his life, Rosemary Alexander from member station KTOO reports that Rogers' most tangible legacy is the University of Alaska Institute of Social and Economic Research, now located on the Anchorage campus.
In 2011, ICER, as it's known, will celebrate its 50th year of collecting data on all things Alaskan. It was George Rogers who convinced the state legislature in 1961 to create a research center within the university and state government. The Harvard-trained economist accomplished the university part, and for a couple of years, he was the institute. Then, he recalled in this 1986 interview, another resource economist came along named Arlen Tussing.
So we decided to divide the world between us, and I took renewable resources, he took non-renewable resources. That's how he got into energy. And his interest was in the Orient. He had done his PhD work on the Japanese economy, and I took the rest of the world.
In those years, the center had a different name, Institute of Business, Economic, and Government Research. Vic Fisher was hired as the first full-time director in 1966.
When I came on board, we switched it, added social, and government was eliminated because people used to call us ISIGER, which has a rather hard sound, and ICER is much sweeter. Yeah.
Fisher was a delegate to Alaska's Constitutional Convention in the mid-1950s. Rogers was the expert economist and consultant. They collaborated on many projects over the years, and not long after statehood, they were together again at the state's only public policy research institute. Fisher says the center focused on just about all aspects of Alaska development, from agriculture to fishing, mining to timber, tourism, and transportation, as well as human resources, including native issues, education, social welfare, health care.
We used to be known back in the 60s and 70s as the Institute of Everything.
ICER was the only think tank in the state at a time when oil companies were drilling exploratory wells, the Kenai gas fields were discovered, and Prudhoe Bay and the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline were on the horizon. Rogers, Tussing, and Fisher studied the economic and social impact of the proposed pipeline, the first analysis of the income the new state would get from oil.
The kinds of billions of dollars, that kind of range wasn't even conceived in those early years of oil enthusiasm.
Just before the 1969 oil lease sale that put Alaska on the world's petroleum map, ICER hosted the Alaska Science Conference under the title Change in Alaska, People, Petroleum, and Politics. Rogers chaired the conference and edited the proceedings. Greg Erickson was 27 years old and beginning his career as a resource economist at ICER. He recalls that Rogers reached into the ranks of the younger scholars and promoted his analysis of the state's oil and gas leasing system, Erickson suggesting the new state should get $3 billion for the oil lease sale.
He decided that was one of the key papers that was given at the conference and sort of headlined it. It resulted in articles in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, and I don't think that would have happened if George hadn't have made such a big deal about it. I mean, here I was, 27 years old, right? And there were a lot of luminaries much more experienced with petroleum issues at that science conference.
Though ultimately the state received only $900 million from the 1969 sale, the research and ideas presented at that ICER conference were all part of the state's future planning and developing relationship with the oil industry. Gordon Harrison first met George Rogers in 1969 when Harrison arrived at UAF as an ICER professor. Not only has the Institute thrived,
it has made a huge contribution to our understanding of social and economic issues in Alaska.
Harrison says before ICER, Rogers' first two books, entitled The Economic Consequences of Statehood and Alaska in Transition, were the only published sources of information about Alaska's economy.
Anybody who wanted to know anything about Alaska had to read those books. They were essentially all there was in the way of sort of academic, serious discussion of developments here.
Rogers' understanding of Alaska and its evolving economy provided the foundation for much of ICER's work since the early 1960s. Vic Fisher is now Professor Emeritus. He says the 2011 commemoration of 50 years of public policy research will include special publications, statewide forums, and web programs, all dedicated to its founder, George Rogers, a decision that was made several months before his death. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, Adam Kane in Dillingham, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Dan Ross in Fairbanks, and Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. The Federal Aviation Administration sets rules for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, and when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.